I thought I was okay, and I wasn't. It wasn't until I was put under pressure that the cracks showed. And it's filmed and millions of people watch it, which makes it worse. But the margins are so, so fine. And then when you can't rely on your top performance for whatever reason, it all falls apart.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Dara Ennis. You might know him from two of the biggest TV quiz shows in the UK, The Chase and Beat the Chasers, where, as a professional quizzer, he has to answer more questions correctly than the contestants during head-to-head rounds. He's from Rathcoole in southwest Dublin, got his PhD in Maynooth University before swapping it all for life in Canada and Oxford. Now he has one of the most famous faces in the UK and Ireland, with global fame beckoning as a new spin-off of The Chase is coming soon. He's the author of two books, one called The Body, 10 Things You Should Know, and another one due out soon about memory. He's been in Ireland lately with his own ultimate pub quiz and would just love to see the return to our screens of Blackboard Jungle. Dara Ennis, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Before we talk all things quizzes and so forth, give me a bit about your background. As I mentioned, growing up in Rathcoole.
Yeah, so I grew up in Rathcoole in County Dublin. I have three older brothers and a younger sister. And my parents moved into the house after they got married, and my mother's still there, so since 1969. And it was a great place to grow up, really great place to live. Went to school locally and loved it. And I'm still really good friends with my mates from school. We still go away together as a group, about 30 or 40 of us. I'm told this is really unusual that so many people from school are still friends sort of 25 years later.
And what's this about you being suspended or thrown out of primary school? Was it twice?
Oh yeah, twice. Yeah.
How or why?
I have always had a very serious disregard for authority, and I always thought that I shouldn't have to listen to these people, even as a child. So both times were for swearing at teachers. I think 9 or 10 year old the first time, and in sixth class, so I would have been 12 the second time. Yeah, I was a person that if my children act like me, I would never forgive them. I was never in trouble. I wasn't in trouble every day, but I lost my temper and had no patience.
Were you just bored?
A lot of the time, yes. So there was 31 kids in my class in fifth and sixth class, and I was the only one who had to sit on their own because I got bored and distracted really easily.
Was it because you felt the class was behind you in regard to what was being taught at the time or what?
Yeah, it moved very slowly. And that's, when you've got 31 kids in your class, the teacher has to keep with the slowest paced kids. And I, at that point in my life, had no patience whatsoever.
What were you like in second level school or in secondary school?
I didn't get in as much trouble. I was very lazy, though. I realised very early on that I didn't need to work very hard. So I didn't really study for exams. I didn't work all that hard. If I liked the teacher and I liked the subject, I put a bit of work in. But if I didn't, I just drifted.
Did you have favourite subjects then based on the teachers?
So I really liked science. But then when I went into Leaving Cert and I did biology, which I now have a PhD in, I found it very dull and I didn't like it then. I loved history and geography. My mother's a history and geography teacher. Well, was. I always was into those. And yeah, depending on the teacher, it was really down to if the teacher got my interest, then I'd like it.
Were you sporty as a youngster?
I wanted to be, but I was terrible at it. I'm really good at very, very little. So I've managed to weaponize them for my career. I've got a very good memory. I was always good at school, but I loved football, but I was never any good at it.
Yeah. Do you have perfect recall? If somebody says something once, is all you need to hear it?
No. So that's a fiction, actually. It doesn't exist in the world. There's a thing called high autobiographical memory recall or something like that. And you can remember really large details, but the photographic memory thing doesn't exist.
So from Rathcoole at secondary school and primary level, you went on to Maynooth University, probably the one closest to you in that area. You struggled initially, did you?
I did in one subject in maths. So I did pretty well in maths in the Leaving Cert without really trying. But once we'd stepped up into the realms of calculus, I really struggled. I genuinely did. And I was in serious danger of failing first year, just in maths. So we had multiple subjects. But he's now a very good friend of mine, Dr. Kieran McInbord. He's now heads up the maths sort of support centre in Maynooth, and he was a tutor at the time, and he basically got me over the line in first year. Once I got to that, I was okay.
But was it that you hadn't applied yourself sufficiently, or was there genuinely a difficulty in just getting your head around stuff?
Yeah, it was at that point. The university changed me. I went from being the laziest student to a very studious student. I went to every lecture. I studied for exams. But there was just some concept of it that I couldn't fit into my mind with one particular type of maths. And I really, really struggled with it. And it was something that I just had to force myself through. And then once I got past that, I was okay.
So that wasn't for want of effort. Unlike, just to roll back a little bit to your second level experience, you managed to miss the mocks. Something very important.
I didn't miss the mocks. I went to the Cheltenham to the races to skip the mocks. So I went to school with Ruby and Ted Walsh. They were in school with me. So it was a horse racing kind of school. And I went with my parents. We skipped off to Cheltenham and I missed my Leaving Cert mocks.
Your second level, your history teaching second level mother brought you to Cheltenham during the mocks.
Of course, priorities. My dad and mother went to Cheltenham every year for like 30 years. And once we made it over about the age of 16 or 17, they brought the kids as well.
What did the school say?
They weren't impressed. My vice principal, a lovely man named Johnny Walsh, who I have ultimate time for, I don't know how he had the patience to put up with me and my friends, was very unimpressed that I would take my Leaving Cert so unseriously. But I genuinely didn't care.
What were Ruby and the brother like in school? Were they a bit like you?
No. Ruby was in the year ahead of me, so I didn't know him as well. But Ted was in my year, and he is a massive personality and was always really good fun. But he was much more interested in horses than school, to be honest. And from his family, you can understand.
Well, I suppose not from the street to the lick it up, knowing Ted Senior. So anyway, you come through, you get over that hump with maths, and then biology became your big thing.
Yeah, it did. And I had a great time, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And weirdly, a lot of the things I'm going to say, well, something happened by accident and I happened to take advantage of it. A friend of mine got sick in the summer between third and fourth year, and she couldn't go. This is my friend Nadine. She couldn't go on a field trip. And one of my mates said, look, do you want to come last minute? So I just, yeah, sure. And I went on a field trip to Mayo. It was the ecology field trip and I had a brilliant time. And I had, do you know what, actually, I finally found something I want to do. So I wanted to do ecology because my friend got the flu, basically. And I ended up doing my fourth year project in an ecology lab, and I did a PhD in ecology then after that. So, yeah, it was just accidental.
So what great revelations did you come across or discoveries in the course of your PhD?
So in the course of my PhD, we were trying to find a way to control insect pests, but without using chemicals. And there's a thing, you can buy it now, you can order it online or you can get it from like garden centres. They're called nematodes, microscopic worms. You put them in your watering can, you pour them on your plants and they crawl around through the soil and they kill loads of pests. It's nice, environmentally friendly, really nice way of doing it. And we were trying to do that in forestry. We put loads of effort into it. It was headed up by a brilliant postdoc, Aoife Dillon. And we had this huge field trials and we did loads of behavioural stuff, environmental assessments. And it worked really, really well. And then when we presented this to a growers thing at a forestry conference, they had no interest whatsoever, even though it was cheaper, better and better for the environment.
And would have done the same job, as you
said,
more efficiently.
A better job. And there's less damage to the crop as well, because when you spray on the new seedlings, the insects have to feed on the seedling to ingest the pesticide. So they get inherently damaged, whereas ours would stop that from happening.
And there was you and who else in this effort or initiative?
So it was headed up by the head of the lab, Professor Christine Griffin. And Aoife Dillon was the sort of senior person who was running the field trials. And she got me my job. My interview for the PhD was, would you like to do a PhD? That was the entirety of it, because I'd worked as a summer student on the project. And I said, yeah, let's do it. And she headed up everything. She was brilliant. And I was working in the lab on behavioural stuff, trying to optimise.
It wasn't all work and no play. You met the love of your life in Maynooth.
Yeah, yeah. So I worked in an ecology lab. So I worked around the corner from the muscle biology lab. And my wife, Joan, was doing her PhD there. We set up the surf club in Maynooth together. We founded it with a few of our friends. And we were really, really good friends before we got together. And we've been married for like 13 years.
Where do you go surfing in Maynooth?
Not on the canal, doesn't work. We used to go to Sligo and Donegal, but we also, when we got our first funding, instead of buying equipment, we went to the Canary Islands instead, because we were in charge and we thought that was way more fun. So we went to Fuerteventura. but we used to go to the West Coast and down to Clare and down to Waterford and stuff. And I think the club is still going, and I think it's the biggest club in the university at the minute.
So then from Maynooth, you headed on to Montreal, was it?
I did. I worked for a year for a biotech company, well, not a biomedical company in Leopardstown. I didn't like that because it was very restrictive because you're working within regulations and academic research is incredibly free, so you can do stuff. So when my wife Joan got a job in Montreal, she got a job offer, I went with her. Yeah.
How did that go?
Good and bad. So my job was, I was largely self-funded and getting grants and things, which was very, very difficult. And Canadian weather is atrocious. It is either freezing cold or roasting hot. And the difference between coldest and hottest can be like 70 degrees swing. So you go from like minus 30, minus 40 up to plus 35 or 40 within a few months. And there's a very small sweet spot where an Irish guy like me who likes it when it's like 18 degrees, when it's actually that kind of weather. But I made a lot of good friends there and I had a great time. And I got into Gaelic football in Canada, weirdly. I never really played in Ireland.
The GAA's tentacles, they're everywhere. I will come back to that in the Oxford setting a little later on. But so what did you do work-wise or research-wise in Canada?
So I was still insects. So I've always been interested in insects and ecology. And I was working in maple syrup plantations. So there's a pest of maple syrup plantations called forest tent caterpillars. And they have outbreaks and they go from very small background populations to millions, so many that you can hear them eating when you walk into the forest. It's pretty weird and creepy. And we were trying to figure out why they go into outbreak because there's no real logical sense. It's not a national outbreak. It's really local and regional. And sometimes there'll be an outbreak one place and a mile down the road there isn't. And then 2 years later, that place has an outbreak. So we were trying to figure out what the triggers were.
Did you?
It's a very complex system and we had almost no funding. So we found out a few little bits, but we needed way more time, way more money, way more people researching it. And I know people will think, oh, maple syrup. Maple syrup is a massive industry in Canada. It's worth millions and millions. They've a maple syrup reserve, quite literally in Quebec. So we were able to sort of chip away at it, but it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. It's a very complex system.
And then it was back to the UK. Again, you were trailing after. You were the trailing spouse, I think is the phrase used
every
in academic
time.
Circles.
Yeah, so my wife is in every way a better scientist than me. Always has been. She was...
Does she say that?
No, because she's very humble. But I think that she's amazing. She always published better papers. She always got the big job offers. I always followed her around.
And I suppose, the proof of the pudding, she had a job in Oxford. You came and you had a pretty long stretch when you were just knocking on doors or filling out applications.
Everything. So I kept a spreadsheet through boredom and because I'm a nerd on 104 jobs I applied for before I got an interview. And that included paid by the hour jobs. I got turned around there and by supermarkets. I, even in desperation, applied for teacher training, which I didn't really want to do. I wanted to stay in research. But eventually I got a job as a lab assistant in the biochemistry department.
That must have been very dispiriting for you.
Yeah, it was, especially because we were in a new city. We didn't know anyone. We were staying in basically a rented room and John was working all day. You know, she was out for 9 or 10 hours a day and I was sitting on my own. And because we only had one income, we didn't have tons of money. And I was very bored and very dispirited. And it just, when I think I applied for a job in Marks and Spencer's as a Christmas temp and they turned me down. And I think that was the...
that has to be the lowest.
That was the lowest point. I'm like, I've got a PhD and what do I need to do to get this sort of like anything? I wanted it not as much for the money, just for something to do.
Would you have worked in a pub? I presume you applied for those kind of jobs.
Yeah,
well.
But then I applied for everything, like everything. I went to shops, I went to pubs, I went to, you know, I applied for science jobs, I applied for science companies. It was just that weird period of time.
And how long was that period where you applied for the 100, was it 102?
So it was 3 or 4 months. Right. So I started, we were out there in October. And I started my job in the biochemistry department in January the following year.
It was probably worth waiting for in the sense that it was kind of up your street.
Yeah, well, the thing about this is, like everything I say, things just happen to me and I take advantage of them. I very rarely have a plan. I just kind of pivot and make the most of what I've got. So I'd never applied to work in this kind of lab before because up until now I've been working in forests and things. This was very different scientifically.
You know. Being Oxford, it must have been fairly well resourced compared to what you'd been used to.
When I was in Maynooth, there was one, what's called a confocal microscope, which is a special kind of microscope, in the department. And you had to wait and queue to get on it. And the technician drove it because they didn't want anyone damaging it because there was only one. My lab had 12 people in it and we had 3 and we built a fourth in the time I was there. We had about £2 million worth of equipment in my lab.
So again, what was the stuff you worked on there?
So there we were still working on insects. So it was fruit flies, which are a common model, the ones you get in your house, weirdly. And we were working on their nervous system, so how their brains worked and how memories are made, but at a molecular level, like one molecule at a time.
These tiny little creatures, they have brains.
Yeah, and they're quite complex.
Memories.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact,
can you tell?
Oh, you can test it. You know, you can test them. You can do a memory test. So you can associate a particular smell or a particular sound with a positive or negative stimulus, and they'll go towards or away from it afterwards, even a long time afterwards. There's so many Nobel Prizes have been awarded for research in fruit flies. Like, we understand our sense of smell, circadian rhythms, chromosomes. That was all research that was done on flies.
And how long were you in that lab?
Nearly 14 years. It was a great job, a really great job.
And to what extent did the sum of human knowledge increase over that period as a result of your efforts and those of others?
So we were working away. One of the misconceptions with science is most of the time you don't have a breakthrough that cures a disease. You know, you increase the knowledge of a very narrow area and it all builds together. So we were able to screen, in one of the projects I did, 200 genes for potential in being involved in memory formation and loss. And doing that en masse is impossible in higher organisms. You can't do it in rats and mice. You can't do it in humans because you can't remove the brains. You can't do the kind of experiments we did. So that alone will mean that someone who works in mice will have a starting point. They'll go, okay, this brilliant study did all of this work. We will work on the equivalent of mice.
So they don't have to go down. There's no return to go. At least they can start.
They can filter. They start with a head start and they know, okay, if it's in flies, it's not always, but it's likely going to be similar in mammals. And they can use that as a starting point. And we're able to do that on a huge scale. It was like 20 people involved over 6 or 7 years. But it would take probably centuries for people to do it in mice. So we were able to really cut that down. And it builds up the field of knowledge and the background of something that we don't really understand all that well.
You must have got great satisfaction from that, Dara.
It was a brilliant job. Mm. And really nice people, really talented people that I work with. And we did, like, we published method papers as well. That's the other thing. It wasn't just the end results. We had to make up new ways of doing things and to make them more efficient. So when we first started doing that screening project, it cost like thousands of pounds to do screen one gene. We were able to make it so that it's like tens. We made it 100 times more efficient.
Meanwhile, I won't say back in the real world, but you reconnected with the GAA in Oxford.
Yeah, I did. So I played in Canada. And in Canada, luckily, the standard...
Sorry, did you play in Kildare before you went to
Canada? No, I never played. I never played at my local club in Rathcoole. Well, they're in Sagart, actually, St. Mary's, had really good teams. You know, some of my friends were on, you know, underage panels of Dublin, that kind of thing. I was never that good. So I couldn't be that person. I was never any good at sport. But when I went to Canada, it was like nine aside.
It's a bit narrower.
It's a bit shallower, definitely. Yeah. And not only that, but they play it in a different way. You know, they do rolling substitutions, it's smaller pitches, just through necessity because they don't have the number of players. And that suited me fine. And it was much less serious, way more fun. You know, it was taken in that kind of spirit. And I played and I played. But then by the time I moved to Oxford, I was sort of the wrong side of 30. And the level in England is obviously a significant step up from Canada. You know, it's much better. It's played more seriously. I played a handful of games. You know, I went training for a year or so. But I gave it my best.
But one of the great things about the GAA, there's always a role somewhere for everybody.
Yeah, so I ended up being on the committee. I accepted that my playing days, as poor as they were over. And I ended up the registrar and I was on the committee. I still am technically on the committee of Aero Og Oxford, but I'm so busy I can't do an active role. Mostly I do fundraising.
And then was it a GAA pub quiz team that you joined?
Yeah, so there's an Oxfordshire quiz league that's long established. It's been running for ages. Weirdly, Paul Sinha played on the team I now play on. But years before I moved to England, he played on them for a short period of time. So we both have played for the same team accidentally, again, just by coincidence. And the team was mostly made up of lads from the GAA club. And we played in an Irish pub around the corner from my house where I lived. And they were short a player one day and I joined in. I said, oh, this is good fun. So I still play on that team. On Thursdays we play. Weirdly, a lot of people think we completely dominate the league and we don't. We got absolutely battered by one of the teams last week. They've got multiple people on the team who've won Mastermind. The standard in the Oxford Quiz League is incredibly high.
Yeah, but because people looking at you sort of, you know, being in the place, they know you obviously from the TV show, and they say, oh, I mean, it's a bit like sort of playing a five-a-side, but David Beckham is on one of the other teams.
Yeah. Well, no, so in terms of competitive quiz, I'm actually not that high up. I'm very, very, very quick. I'm good at quick recall. I don't get pressured by cameras. I don't have stage fright. Huge bonuses for the chase. I'm a good quizzer. But when it comes to international competitions and everything, really obscure knowledge, really like knowing absolutely everything about everything, you know, that's not me at all. I am very much a general knowledge kind of quizzer. So Paul Sinha and Anne Hegarty, they do these competitions and they do really well.
They're your fellow chasers.
Yeah, so on the chase. They go and they rank, and Paul has been number one ranked in Britain and stuff. I don't do those competitions because I don't find them interesting. So in terms of competitive quizzing, I'm very much middle of the road. Yeah.
So it started not with the chase. There was another quiz that you entered, a TV show. You came close to winning, but you didn't quite get there.
Yeah, so I came second. So it was called Rebound, and no one had ever heard of it because it was a new show. So didn't know what to expect, went on, and it was really good fun, really nice people. And I made it to the final two. I think there was six or eight contestants on the episode. But the final was based almost exclusively on how quickly you answered. And I kept trying to get the right answer and have a think. And the person beside me, and who ended up making it through to the final, openly admitted, she said, when I didn't know, I just mashed the buttons. She just pressed them all at the same time because she realised that the punishment for getting it wrong was way less than the punishment for waiting. So she ended up pipping me to the final and made it through. So yeah, I'd never won any money.
But then another drawer opened.
Yeah, well, I needed a back door, so literally another door opened. So, we just bought our house, our first house, and Oxford and Dublin are very similar in house price terms. It's a very expensive place to buy a house. And we had no money, absolutely zero. I had to get my brother to buy us a fridge because we didn't have enough money to buy a fridge. We stretched ourselves as far as we could go. And when we moved in, the previous owner had hand-built their own conservatory, which was a bit ramshackle, and couldn't be locked. The door was broken. And the back door had been removed completely. So it was so cold in our house. And doors are extraordinarily expensive. I was completely naive. I thought I could get a door for a couple of hundred quid. And it was like, you know, heading way towards... Then it was quite a while ago, 1,000. It's probably more now. So I applied to be on a quiz show to win some money so we could get a door for our house.
And thus began 7 years, I think it is.
Yeah.
Is at this stage with the chase.
Yeah, I know. It's really strange. So that was...
You made quite the first impression, didn't you?
Yeah. So it was a really weird experience. I was on the show with three people I'd never met. That's the premise of the show. And we were playing the game and I did really well. You know, I answered a lot of questions right. I put a lot of money into the bank. I thought, this is brilliant. If I get a share of this, I can get a door, you know. But then the other three people on my team, who I have absolutely no ill will for whatsoever, a lot of other people have ill will for them, took a lower offer. So you can take lower or negative offers to increase your chances of getting to the final. And I was perfectly fine with this at the time. I didn't think anything of it. We won some money. I was in a studio for 2 hours, got to hang out with Bradley Walsh and won like 1,600 quid. That is a great morning as far as I'm concerned. But people got so angry when it aired. Like they were debating Article 50 about leaving the EU in Parliament the same day. And the number one trending thing on Twitter was my show on The Chase, hashtag justice for Dara, because they were so angry at these people.
So much so the GoFundMe page was set up.
They raised money. They tried to raise money to give me back the money that I'd lost. And I hadn't lost any money. That's not how the game works. It's not real until you win at the end. So yeah, people were very passionate about
it. You were very honourable, not to say charitable, with the resulting fund that was built up for you.
I gave it away, yeah. I don't think I deserved it, and I thought it was wrong of me to take it. I begged them not to do it, and they did it anyway. But I didn't
want... How much
did
it come to?
It was over £1,000, I think. But... I was like, I can't.
You had your door.
Yeah, but it's not about money. It's about what's the right thing to do, you know. And it was wrong. It would have been wrong to take people's money. I didn't deserve that money. I won by the rules of the game. I got exactly what I deserved. That's how games work, you know. And I just felt it was wrong. So there's a local hospice in Oxford who are a great charity. They're called Helen and Douglas House, if anybody's feeling generous. And I gave the money to them.
And then you kept on appearing on the show.
Yeah, so at that point, little did people know, I was already auditioning to be a chaser on the show by that point. So fairly soon after it aired, maybe a year or so after my episode aired, I came on as the new chaser.
So what do you think they saw in you that kind of piqued their interest in bringing you in as a chaser?
So one is I'm a little bit different. None of the others, all of the others are English, though Anne and Jenny both play for Ireland in quiz, weirdly. But so a little bit different in that respect. I have no idea of being camera shy or getting stage fright, which is a huge problem for a lot of people who would do the job. And I had so much fun on the day with Brad that I was cracking jokes and all that kind of thing. And I think that interaction, people forget that this is, while it's technically a quiz show, it's really an entertainment show with a quiz that happens in the background. So I think that part was a big part of it.
Yeah, he's quite an entertaining character. He seems to have a lot of life experience.
Oh, but Brad has lived the like most rich life. He was a former professional footballer. He was on the books at Brentford. He had to retire very young, I think, because of injuries. He was, you know, I think he was in Pontins or Butlins as an entertainer. He did comedy circuit. He still does, you know, he does like cabaret shows, and he's had a couple of number one albums. He's been in Doctor Who. He hosts quiz shows. He's been in Coronation Street. He's done all the things.
And of course, he gave you a new identity, as it were, on the show.
Yeah, the Menace. Yeah, that was the first time I heard it as well. A lot of people think I would have workshopped that or anything. They literally, I don't know.
You walked onto the set,
and he said it out loud. That's the first time I heard it. I don't know why they did that, because it's not like I needed the surprise or the shock. But yeah, that was it.
Dara
the Ennis the Menace, yeah.
Great fun. So you just roll with it.
Oh yeah. Oh, that's the number one thing about doing the show, is you just roll with it. You keep
and
going.
What kind of training did you get for the role of Chaser?
So there's quite a lot of knowledge gaps if you don't grow up in the UK. And it seems like very, very obvious knowledge. It's the same as here. You know, they have slightly different nursery rhymes. They might ask something like, where does this motorway go? And if you're English and you've been around the country, no problem. But, you know, they're not going to know. They're not going to know where the N7 goes to or the M4 goes to. So it's the same kind of thing. There's a lot of basic history, pop culture, geography that are considered what we call level one, very easy questions that someone who didn't grow up in the UK wouldn't have the slightest idea what they are. So I had to work a lot on that kind of thing.
And what about, say, entertainment or, you know, pop culture, that kind of thing?
Pop culture is my weak point. I can't care about, you know, what the latest reality show is, or and I've never really watched the soaps. But in general entertainment, because there's so much cultural overlap between the UK and Ireland, that wasn't all that difficult. You know, I've seen the same movies. We listen to a lot of the same music. We had English TV when I was growing up. So there was a lot of that I had, but yeah, a lot that I didn't.
So how do you go about retaining stuff? Now, you say the idea of perfect recall actually doesn't exist. You were saying that earlier. So how do you have to do serious spotting for, you know, when you're getting ready for a program, or how does that work?
So I put in quite a lot of work. So at the moment we're in a gap between filming, but we're back at the end of the month. So once I finish my time in Ireland and I go home, I'll put in 2, 3, 4 hours most days.
Doing what?
Learning lists quite a bit. So, you know, going back over the reigns of the kings and queens of England and the host cities of the Olympics and the periodic table and capital cities, that kind of thing, which come up a lot. And I'll watch episodes of The Chase that I wasn't the chaser, and I'll try and see how I do and figure out where I'm getting things wrong. I'll watch a lot of other quiz shows, and I have a book of notes on everything from, you know, the Academy Awards to synopsis of Dickens and Shakespeare and bestsellers and the Booker Prize and all that kind of thing.
And what about, say, football and who won what, you know, sort of the FA Cup final in 1978 or whatever it would be?
That kind of thing doesn't come up on the show all that often. That's the thing. So I'm not an expert in everything. I know a very small amount about a large number of subjects. So I try and cherry pick ones that are likely to come up. And they're very, very rare that they'll go really specific. And if they do, the volume of information you would need to retain to be sure of getting all those is so vast that it's actually not worth the trouble.
When it comes to the one-to-one quizzes, there's 2 minutes for the contestant and then 2 minutes for you to try and match them. Let's say there was a kid, I think his name was Eden.
Oh yeah, he won loads of money.
He did. But I think he got, was it 18 or 19?
On his own,
right?
Yeah.
On his own.
Yeah.
And you then had to, in the space of 2 minutes, try to beat that.
Yes.
Now, I mean, like, this is where I suppose a guy like Bradley has to come through with his split-second timing and the brevity and everything like that. And then you have to make the most of trying to answer 18 questions in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Takes a lot of concentration. And as you say, the speed element is more important than the thinking element.
Yeah, you need to have, if you have to sit and think about it, that's a huge problem. Once you get above about 18, once you're approaching 20, or if you go over 20, then the amount of room for error is really low. So Brad can get through, he's amazing at this. Realistically, he can get through maybe 24 questions in 2 minutes. He can do, you know, 12, 13 in a minute. That's as fast as he can go getting answers back and forth. And that's if we interrupt a couple as well. So if you've got a lot of time to think, you can think. But most of the time, you just need to snap the answer out straight away.
How important is it for you to try to beat the contestant?
Oh, I'm really competitive. This is the only thing I've ever been good at. So I said I was always terrible at sport, never artistic, can't sing. I can't dance a single step. I have no sense of rhythm. I have no other sort of measurable things. It was doing exams and answering quiz questions. So this is one thing I'm mega competitive at.
And would there not be a bit of you saying, oh, look, there's this kid here. He's 20 years of age. God, it'd be nice to see him win. Maybe I might just pause for a second.
Not even the tiniest amount. I want to crush every single team. I don't just want to beat them. I want to beat them so comprehensively that they walk away dispirited. The thing is, if they played well enough, they'd win. There is an advantage to the contestants. So they get head starts in the final. So every one of them that gets back gets a question head start. And if we get one wrong, they can push us back. If there is no way any of the chasers would not beat the person sitting up in the chair if the roles were reversed. We would always win because there is an edge. So if they play well enough, they'll win. And if they don't win, it's their own fault.
Is there an element of trying to psych them out of it when that moment comes and, you know, the reveal is, well, who's the chaser here?
Yeah, there is a bit. So you're trying, you can see sometimes, you can watch, and when you're walking down, you can see the person is nervous. You can see them sort of, you know, twiddling their fingers or, you know, not looking you in the eye and things. And it's quite intimidating. We're quite high up.
And you have a game face.
Yeah. Oh, you got to have the game face. My game face is terrible. I'm good at it for a second. But my first episode, I was told I had to stop looking like I was enjoying myself too much because I was meant to be really menacing, and I can't do it. I love the job. So
to live up to your name.
Yeah, I just can't do it.
And how embarrassing is it if you're beaten by the contestant? I mean, we mentioned that kid, Eden. He won 75 grand.
Yeah, good, isn't it? That was one of my first big losses. And I walked back and sort of a bit sheepishly said to the, you know, the head of the production company, sorry about that. And he goes, it's not your money. It's going to be great TV. And that's the thing. The point of the show isn't for us to win. The point of the television show is to entertain people. And I've had to adopt that. It can be very dispiriting if you play badly and lose. I didn't play particularly badly against Eden. He set a really good score and I lost to it. And that's fine. Losing to an 18, it's not a big deal. But if you lose much lower, if you lose down sort of 12, 13, 14, you're going, oh God, that was terrible. It's like if you're doing anything competitive. If you're playing a game of football or a game of golf or whatever it is, and you lose to someone who happens to be playing better than you, but you play a decent game, you play all right, you go, that's not bad. But if you play terribly and someone who you really should beat beats you, that's a bit of a kick.
Has that happened much?
It has happened a bit. I had, actually, it went out very recently on UK TV. I don't know if it's been on Irish TV, where I basically collapsed in the final. I got 10 questions wrong, which is a record for me. And after that, I took a break from filming. And the producer sent me to a sports psychologist, weirdly.
Was that around the time that your dad died?
Yeah, a couple of months afterwards.
And was there a connection between the two things?
Yeah, I thought I was okay and I wasn't. It wasn't until I was put under pressure that the cracks showed. And this is the thing, I felt fine until I didn't. And the margins are so fine, and it's filmed and millions of people watch it, which makes it worse. But the margins are so, so fine. And then when you can't rely on your top performance for whatever reason, it all falls apart.
So how long was the break?
It was a few months. Now, we were coming towards the end of a block anyway, so there would have been a block in the middle. But I had a good few sessions with, actually, the people who coach quite a lot of the British Olympic team. I know this sounds weird.
That sounds very high-end.
I am not athletic at all. But it's, if you think about it logically, mentally, it's the same idea. It's a very short, intense, high performance moment where you have to perform at a high level under high pressure while people are watching.
What kind of advice did you get then from the psychologist?
So one of the things was, you know, about grounding yourself, about, you know, what are the consequences of you not doing well? And to be honest, there aren't any. You know, it every so often, if we won all the time, it would be terrible TV. We have to lose occasionally. That happens. What are the consequences of you doing badly and you have a bad day? Everybody has a bad day. No one has ever gone through life without having a bad day. You know, and that sort of reframing it. But the other one is to try and dispel, when you get a question wrong, one of the worst things, and we see it with contestants all the time, is you stop focusing on what the next question is. It's the worst thing you can do. You get mad and you get emotional. You have to sort of ground yourself. And she told me to do it, actually, literally, is to push your feet into the ground and feel the sensation of the ground against your feet. And just completely do that. And weirdly, because you're focusing on something else, part of the stress and the anger and the upset goes away. So that's what I do now. I sit and I go, take a deep, big, deep breath, push my feet down. I go, everything's okay. I can feel my feet.
Were you edgy or nervous about getting back on the horse?
The very first one, yes. But then it went away. So it was a case of once Brad said, are you ready? Which he does before we do. Okay, your time starts now. It went away. As soon as the clock started counting, I went, poof, I was back in game mode again.
And it's as though, from what you were saying earlier, Dara, the cameras aren't there. There's no lights. There's no rasp. I mean, like the music alone, just watching the show.
It's great, isn't it?
It just, it's like being in the cinema, you know, it really comes at you.
Yeah, it does. And it's a great score. It's composed by a guy called Paul Farrer, actually. He does loads of TV scores, but it's a really good score. But I don't care. I don't even, and there's a clock. I don't look at the clock. There's a clock. We have a visible clock on a screen where above the contestant's head, it's off camera. So we know the countdown. I don't look at it. I stopped looking at it once by accident and I did better.
How do they go about organising the questions or drafting the questions? Because you want to, I presume, to have questions that an ordinary watching member of the audience has a reasonable chance of getting a few of them at any given moment. But then, you know, it's not mastermind. It's a totally different thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the thing. One of the reasons why it's successful is that there is a mixture of levels of questions. And everybody at home will probably get a few of them, you know. And that's one of the keys to success. The question writers, the chasers, we give them such a terrible time. We are always complaining. Always. Every single one of us kicks off about, oh, that wasn't the balance set and that wasn't a very well worded question, because we don't like to lose. We're all very competitive. And the easiest people to blame are always the question setters. But they do a brilliant job. And it's such a hard job to do. And I don't know how they do it, because for very good reasons, we are not allowed to have anything to do.
I mean, do you know who they are?
Oh yeah, yeah. I know them personally. Like, we see them because they come in, they're on set. So when Brad talks to him about pronunciations and emphasis of words to make sure he gets it exactly right, he runs through the questions with them very, very carefully. He's an ultimate, he does act like a child a lot of the time because he's really good fun, but he is an ultimate professional, and they're always on site to double check questions, double check answers, and as an independent adjudicator as well.
Are there moments where the show has to literally stop recording because of maybe there might be a challenge to the accuracy of an answer or something like that?
Yeah, so there's a company called Beyond Dispute, and they do quite a few quiz shows. A woman called Olivia runs it. And if we or the contestants have any qualms whatsoever, we go, sorry, can I question that? I'm not sure that's phrased right, or I think there's possibly two answers. And sometimes, you know, I have interrupted the show because I think the contestant's answer was technically correct, that was given wrong. You know, we all want it to be fair, and everything is stopped, everything is checked really, really carefully and really rigorously. It's a very difficult show to win, but it's incredibly fair.
Your experience where you had to take that leave, is that what prompted you to write your next book? It's about memory. Is something you're dedicating to your dad?
It was always in the works already. So it kind of ties all of my life together. So I worked in like a neuroscience lab, literally trying to figure out how memories happen. I memorized things for a living. And then, you know, like so many people, I've seen one of my family members go through dementia and die from it in the end. So I thought, whenever I've talked to people about this, very few people understand how memories work. They always say, oh, how do you remember stuff, or what happens during dementia? And we don't know. So I really wanted to write an accessible science book about memory. It wasn't particularly spurred on by my dad, but there's a chapter about him in the book because that's my personal experience with dementia.
What was his journey through dementia like? Because it's never the same for two people, is it?
No, no, it's not one disease. It's a suite of diseases. It's kind of like cancer, you know. People say, oh, I have cancer, but there's very different types and some are aggressive and some are not. Same with dementia. So his was mercifully quite a slow slide. So I was the one, I first noticed it because I was living away. I was in Canada. And when I came back, because I'd been away for so long, I noticed something was different. And I think people who were around him didn't notice because it was so gradual. But he just very, very gradually drifted and his memory started to go. And it was over more than a decade, which was, in a way, is very fortunate. You know, it means that, you know, you get a lot more time with him and he had a high quality of life for most of that time. It was good.
What did he realise himself about the condition?
He realised that he wasn't able to be the same person anymore. And I think that hurt him a lot. Mm. He realised that it frustrated him very much so that he wasn't able to remember, that he wasn't able to be reliable anymore, because he was always the reliable man, you know, very typical man of his generation. And things like he forgot where he parked his car or, you know, that kind of thing. And then he wasn't able to drive anymore and people were always checking on him. And he was generally quite good natured about it. But you could see deep down, he knew something was wrong, even when it got worse. And he's go, oh, have I said that to you before? And he's like, yeah, but it doesn't matter. And then he'd say the same thing again. And he'd go, oh, have I said that to you before? And you could see something in his mind is going, this is really frustrating.
And was he able to live at home to the end?
Almost to the end. My mother cared for him herself. And we had some carers come in to help later on when it became more difficult. But he was in the care home for less than a year in the end. But that got to the point when he just couldn't be managed.
And was he able to recognise you, say, when you came to visit?
Yes, always. I called him every day.
And was he able to hold a conversation, even if there might have been repetition, that kind of thing?
Towards the end, he found it more difficult. But for most of the time, you would sit. So when I was at home, a couple of years before he died, we were watching, I think, the hurling final, one of the All-Ireland finals. And he was asking, what's the capacity of Croke Park these days? And he must have asked that 30 times in the match, you know. But it was just, you know, that was in his head. And you just do it and you do it and you have the same conversation round and round. But like my children phoned him. We had a video call with him every single day before they went to bed so they could chat to him. He always asked how they were doing. He always got delighted to see them. And until maybe 2 or 3 days before he died, he was chatting to us and he'd light up.
What are you going to tell us about memory then in the book?
So I'm going to tell people what memories are. Dude, like a lot of people don't realise this, but a memory is a physical object in your brain. It's a thing you can see. And a lot of people don't realise that. It's a circuit in your brain that's made. So your short-term memory, everyone thinks it's like hours or days. It's minutes. If you can remember what you did this morning, that has become a physical object in your brain. So some circuit has grown, synaptic connections have grown, and that's a thing. And it's called plastic. The reason why plastic is called plastic is because it's reshapable, and they're reshapable and moldable. And if you don't keep them active, they disappear. That's why you forget things. And that, I think, is a key thing. A lot of people go, oh, how can you remember so much? Because you go over it. If you revise, there's a reason why you revise, restudy. It's because you're solidifying those memories in your brain. And that's how it works. And if you think about any sort of thing that you can remember ever, ever, ever in your life, that means you have refired some circuit that you made possibly decades ago.
Just a couple of hours before we started this conversation, Dara, I was at a funeral and I met somebody there who I hadn't seen for probably 25 years.
Yeah.
And she came over and said, hello, Sean. And I'm trying to remember. And then she mentioned something about UCG and I had her name.
Yeah.
And literally 2 days ago, I was introduced to somebody down in Limerick and I'd forgotten his name in less than a minute, I'd say.
Yeah.
Now, that's not unusual.
No.
But why does it happen?
So your brain triages things when it comes in. So it goes, is this important information? And this is not conscious. It's not a snub on anybody that you meet. But part of your mind probably went, this is probably someone I won't talk to again. I won't need to remember.
Or maybe I'm thinking ahead to what I need from the person.
Or what you're thinking. You think about what you're going to say next. Mm. And it just goes away. Whereas the old memories that are in there, you go UCG. So our brains work by association always. This is why things like smell bring back memories really clearly. Mm-hmm. So our brains work by association, and the association of the place and the person and the face fired up the right circuit and it came in. But you never put that other person's name into long-term memory. So it went into your working memory for 30 seconds, up to 2 minutes, 3 minutes. And if your brain didn't put it in, it's gone. And it will. It's not that you've put it into your memory and forgotten. It never got written in the first place.
So will your book have techniques that people can use to improve their memory?
Yeah, one of the chapters is on how to remember things. And the easiest way to do it is to just make things interesting, to like put something in them that means they'll be associated with something else. Mm. So I needed to remember producer's name, Aisling Reardon. So I have my brother married a woman whose surname was Reardon. So I thought about dreaming about my sister-in-law, because Aisling is the Irish word for dream. And that's in my head always, and it'll never go away.
But that must have taken, what, 5-10 seconds for you to do that? I mean, would you have paused when you met Aisling or spoke to her for the first time on the phone to make that connection?
No, I have to actively do it. You know, so I need to think, is this something I need to remember? And if so, I will find a way of doing it.
Suppose you get a name like, I don't know, John Ryan.
John Ryan, so you'd think that's Jack Ryan. So Jack Ryan is the character in the books and the films, Clear and Present Danger, Harrison Fordson. So you go, formal Jack Ryan. There you go.
I heard you in another interview come up with a very interesting way to remember the name of the Speaker of the House of Commons.
Yeah, Lindsay Hoyle, because his name sounds like linseed oil. So you think the benches that he sits on are polished with linseed oil. And the previous one, John Burko, Paul Sinner taught me this actually, is that Speaker is the brightest star in the constellation Virgo. Mm. And John Burko sounds like Virgo. He's the Speaker. And that's how he remembers. So you link those facts together and it works both directions.
There was a lady back in the day, Betty Boothroyd.
Yes, I remember Betty Boothroyd, and she's Betty Boop in my head. So you remember the cartoon character? I picture her in the House of Commons.
So it's all a question of making the links.
Yeah, and then the best thing is if you actively try to do that, you can link those facts together and you can sort of hang the memories off each other. You know, so you can find one thing that links to another that links to another. So the first ever like proper underwater submarine, not a modern one, but in the first person to do an underwater submersible, is a guy called Cornelius Drabble. And I know when he was alive because him and Shakespeare probably knew each other, which is kind of weird to think about. So he was at the court of King James I, so was Shakespeare. So they were probably, there's no direct evidence for this, but they were probably in the same room together. And I know when Shakespeare was alive because I know he was alive during the reigns of Elizabeth I and James I, which I know from there to my list. So those four people are linked together in time. So if it ever asks, when was the first submarine invented? Probably the end of the 1500s or the early 1600s, because that's when they were all alive.
Talking of Shakespeare, you have to have a fairly good idea of the names and the roles of pretty much every character in every one of his plays.
No, not really. I need to know the headline facts. So that's the thing. I'm not an expert on things. I just know the skim at the top. So I know the main characters, maybe one quote. I've my study notes, and every Shakespeare play is about, except for Hamlet, because that's really long, there's loads of quotes in it, is like 3, maybe 4 lines of things that might come up on the show. Mm. I'm really targeted. I go, what will come up on the chase? What should I study for this?
When we were students, Cole's notes were a thing about all the Shakespeare plays, and a lot of people try to get by on the basis of that.
Yeah,
so you're
exactly.
Cole's notes man, yeah. Rather than the full text.
100%, yeah. And
no footnotes.
Yeah, there's no need for it, because as far as I'm concerned, it doesn't need to happen. You know, the chase is not the kind of show that will ask about, you know, a minor character in Troilus and Cressida. It's just not that kind of show, because it's a much more accessible show for general audiences. They might ask about it, maybe, but then it's not worth the trouble to learn it, because it's a very low chance. But they will ask about Hamlet. They'll ask about Romeo and Juliet. They'll ask about Macbeth. And they might ask, maybe, you know, what country are the more obscure ones set in? That's about it.
What sort of screening is done on entrance to the show?
I have no idea. We're not allowed to know. Again, for very obvious reasons. I assume, well, as someone who's gone through the interview process, I know that they do sort of quiz tests and they do a run through of the show and they film you to see if you're good on camera or not. But as
or if
far
you're spooked by it.
Yeah, exactly. Or if you're nervous or things. But as far as the selection criteria, I have absolutely no idea. Not allowed.
So this is now a full-time career for you, is it?
Full-time's a stretch. We don't film that much. It's
no,
my main job.
It's
my main job, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what made you... How long is it since you packed up the lab work?
Oh, like 4 years or something, 3 years like that. I was working part-time up for a while and then my lab moved to Glasgow and that was a good sort of breaking point. But yeah, the chase we film... maybe a couple of hundred episodes a year, but we do 3 shows a day. And with Beat the Chasers in, the total sort of filming time, it's only sort of 70 or 80 days a year. You know, that's the kind of ballpark. It goes up and down.
Yeah, but I mean, a bit like in teaching, you got to do the background work.
Yeah, I do a lot of I do a lot of prep and background. But in terms of actual filming time, I'm only in for 1/6 of those shows as well. So, you know, I might actively be in studio for very few days a year.
What about the new show, the one that's going all over the world?
Yeah, so this is a new spin-off called Chase Around the World. I'm not allowed to give out too many details, but they're currently selecting contestants for it, and it will involve challenges outside of the UK.
Will your passport have to be in order for this?
I will have to be there, yeah. So they'll be doing various challenges, and some of those challenges will involve having to beat chasers at quizzes or quiz type events. And it'll be multiple teams trying to beat each other to the final. But that's all we're allowed to say.
Has this made you very rich?
No. People have a weird idea that the salaries in television are much higher than they are. You have to remember that realistically, the number of people who watch television is massively lower than it used to be. Mm. So at one point, the soaps in the UK were getting like 10, 12, 15 million. But, you know, that doesn't happen anymore. So I'm very privileged. I really like my job. It is good pay, but it's not, I'm not retiring next year or anything like
you
that.
You have enough, as they say. Dara, were you a fan of quiz shows when you were here as a youngster?
Oh, I always loved quiz shows. I used to watch, you know, the UK ones like 15 to 1 and things, but I loved Where in the World and Blackboard Jungle and, you know, that kind of thing. I always liked the quiz show.
Would you see yourself maybe as a quiz master or something like
that? I'd love to. I think, and I've said this before a couple of times, we need to bring Blackboard Jungle back. I think my brother is a principal of a school in Nice, and he says he spends so much money transporting children to things. A minibus as a prize, it was perfect. I think everybody would enjoy it. You'd have two different generations, the people who used to watch it and some of them were on it, with their kids watching it. I think it'd be brilliant. And I really want to host it. I think I'd be good at it.
You more than likely would. You mightn't be the only one looking for the gig, as it were. You also believe that there should be more about science in the media. I mean, more programmes, yeah?
So we don't have science shows for adults anymore. They don't exist. The only one in general science show in Ireland is Future Island, and that's only periodical. It's not regular. And I've been on Future Island. They came to my lab, actually, weirdly. And we have so many people who are being fooled by misinformation. The amount of people who deny the moon landings happen is like jaw-droppingly high. The amount of people who think that the Earth is flat, it's outrageous.
And on the moon landing, you had a very vivid exposure, I suppose, to that. I mean, the level of ignorance about it.
Yeah, so I posted a thing on TikTok about how we only put wheels on suitcases in 1970. That's when the patent was filed. So it's casually said, we landed on the moon before we thought of putting wheels on suitcases. That's humans for you, you know, and I thought that would be the end of it. And the amount of people who weren't questioning it but were laughing at me for, I thought you were clever. How could you possibly think the moon landings happened? Was staggering. Staggering how many. Like, genuinely outraged that I could possibly believe that this thing that definitively happened. We've done a very bad job, scientists. We're very good at like doing our research, but when it comes to communicating in general, we're not great. And I think we need to bring back properly accessible science shows for adults.
Well, that, I suspect, Dara Ennis, is something in which you could play quite a big part. Thank you so much indeed for joining us on the Insights podcast.
Thanks for having me on.
And you can find more Insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RT Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening.